Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're in tune to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and often interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. How does one foster and prevent the perpetuation of trauma? Dr. Cindy Bigby's book, My Link to Mildred, Interrupting the Epidemic of Trauma via Nonviolent Communication, delves into her personal and professional journey into the nonviolent communication. The book, a blend of memoir and instructional guide, emphasizes the role of nonviolent communication in addressing and healing intergenerational trauma. Dr. Bigby shares her experiences and expertise in using NVC as a transformative tool in school, home, workplace, community, and the mitigation of trauma. Her book is also an exploration of the science behind trauma and the impact on human behavior. Joining via Zoom platform is Dr. Cindy Bigby. It's good to have you back. So welcome back to 411 Teen. So glad to have the opportunity to talk with you and get an update with what's happening with you.
Thank you so much, Liz. I know, I don't even know how many years ago it was when I was on it with a bunch of the youth from the Community Connections Restorative Justice Program, which are, there's a whole back section of my book that is in dedication to those kids. They were very formative in writing this book, actually.
Well, I am glad to have you back. I think the information and nonviolent communication is just really invaluable. You've got the new book out, My Link to Mildred, Interrupting the Epidemic of Trauma via Nonviolent Communication. It begins with a deeply personal account of your mother's trauma and its impact on your life. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, to be very blunt, the unforeseen and very quick passing of my mother. She died on May 5th. It'll be 2 years this coming May. And we didn't see it coming. She was from South Florida, came up here with a very bad pain in her neck, which she thought she had pulled during Pilates. And long story short, she came on April 1st and she died May 5th. So Basically in about 4 weeks time, we found out that she had stage 4 lung cancer. And while she was in her dying process, she told me to write this book. Which I knew even for probably 25 years, I had the name of this book. I always knew I was going to write this book. And when my mom died, it was the kind of thing where I didn't even have to work at it. I would wake up at like 4 or 5 in the morning. I just would wake up. My body would wake up and I would go into my office and it more or less poured out of me in a matter of about 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow. What was it about this personal experience with your mother that influenced you to explore and advocate for, again, the nonviolent communication?
I mean, I think when my mom died, we had so much peace, or at least I had a lot of peace, mm-hmm. as did she. Mm-hmm. And with my mom, even though I was really, really close to her my whole life, it wasn't an easy relationship. But I think that learning nonviolent communication throughout the years, and then I have a podcast, my mom started listening to the podcast. She started growing in her communication skills. I've been working at my communication skills for, probably 20 some odd years using the NVC process. And in the last probably couple of years of her life, we had a lot of very very intense and very healing conversations because we were able to use this process. And so I think that I was very much inspired to share about the journey of the trauma that was passed down to my mom through, you know, generations that came before her, that was then passed down to me and showed up in my behavior and still does out there in the world. In fact, the name of the book, my link to Mildred, Mildred is my mother's grandmother, so my great grandmother. And years ago, when I came up with the name of the book, I realized, like, wow, I'm kind of fortunate because I can trace my crazy, if that makes sense. Like, I can trace my crazy. I can see how, like, how I'm showing up in the world, right, or the things that I have insecurities about, you know, or the things that maybe trigger me. There's a direct link to, you know, the way my mother interacted with me, which was a result in how, you know, her father and mother interacted with her, which was a result of how Mildred came into the United States and all the history around, you know, her life. And it was a trickle down. I'm fortunate because there are, you know, there are many people in the world that can't trace that history. And so, yeah, that's, I don't know if that's directly getting to your question, but
yes,
I think it is.
Yes. I mean, because what I hear you saying is that you were conditioned.
Completely.
You
were, yes.
You learned to respond in the way that you did.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there are many people that are responding out there in the world that have no idea that what's really coming out is it's history.
Right.
It's history coming out in their behavior. They don't see it. And then people that are interacting with them are labeling it maybe as crazy or, you know, just some kind of judgment on that without really seeing the full context of what's actually playing out. Between all of us.
Yes, and that's so common because we don't, often we come up with ideas and theories and we don't look at the whole context. We don't look at the whole situation. So I commend you. I thought it was very powerful and very well done. Your book.
Can I just say one
thing?
Sure,
sure.
So just so people can have more of a connection, hopefully, to what we're trying to bring out here. Because I think sometimes when people hear the title nonviolent communication, which is a very specific process of communication that is designed to help bring connection between people, a lot of times people think, well, I don't really need that because I'm not violent.
Right.
Like, I'm not violent. So that doesn't pertain to me. But in this context, nonviolence or violence is considered any kind of interaction that creates disconnection between people is a form of violence. So it doesn't necessarily have to be people physically harming one another, but any kinds of interactions that happen that end up creating more disconnection than connection would be considered a form of violence. And so if that happens in your life, which anybody that's listening out there, I'm guessing if you're a living, breathing human being, that happens many times, maybe throughout a day, right?
Yes.
What can we actually do? This is almost like a lifeline back to connection. This allows us to have a lifeline or a playbook back to connection. Connection is not some abstract concept. That's what I go over in the book. It's a replicable, we can put into place replicable processes that bring us closer to connection every time.
Well, you anticipated my next question because I was going to ask you, explain to us what nonviolent communication is and what it is, what it involves, what it means. And
Well, it was actually developed by a man named Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. He had a PhD in clinical psychology. And he was himself a little bit disillusioned with typical psychology process because he thought that it was pretty harmful to all the labeling that happens, that when we put a label on something, that's a judgment, and that judgment is a big part of so much of the dysfunction that we have in our interactions. And so he actually passed, gosh, I don't even know how many years ago it's been now, probably 7, 8 years. And But his work is continuing on in a very large way. Every year there are more and more certified NBC trainers, even though it takes several years to become a certified trainer because we want to keep the integrity with the process. Mm-hmm. He was up for the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, two times because of his work. Again, it's global. And the concept of nonviolence, a lot of folks say, oh, we shouldn't be calling it that because that in and of itself is a judgmental term, right? The irony
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
But I think it comes more out of Gandhi's concept mm-hmm. of nonviolence. He was very much, of that time and place and learning. And so Marshall Rosenberg named it that because of Gandhi's philosophies around nonviolence.
Cindy, who is your target audience? And I know you laugh because I think as we were talking before we started the interview, I think it could be almost anyone.
That could. It really could. I mean, and it really is. I mm-hmm. mean, you have interactions in your life, right? Even if you don't have interactions in your life, there's a whole piece of this process that's really for you to have better connection with yourself.
Yeah.
And so, but I would say the majority of people out in the world interact with other people. And if you're interacting with other people, then this is a tool. And that's my target audience, because I don't know about you, but I see a lot of dysfunctional interactions. I see a lot of conflict that isn't being productive. Like, conflict doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing at mm-hmm. all. Conflict can, there can be so much learning that occurs as a result of it. There can be greater connection as a result of conflict that is used in a productive manner. But we haven't really mastered that, like not even come close. So I think that my target audience, unfortunately, is every living human being out there. truly. And I know that I put a big emphasis on trauma and interrupting the epidemic of trauma is the subtitle to the book. But I also think most people aren't tracking that they've probably had trauma.
Yeah, exactly.
Research is showing, two thirds of people have had trauma uh-huh. from the ages of 0 to 17. And that has a definite impact on the way that our brains work. We are in a heightened state of
Cindy,
keeping ourselves
allow me
safe.
To interrupt you. Hold your thoughts, okay? This is one of those times. We need to take a quick break, but we'll get back to talking about intergenerational trauma. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Dr. Cindy Bigby. And we are talking about nonviolent communication. Before we went on break, Cindy, I had to interrupt you, but you were talking about intergenerational trauma, and I wanted to ask you to continue with that. You did earlier describe intergenerational trauma, but if you will do that again, and then just share with us how you believe NVC, nonviolent communication, can break that whole cycle of intergenerational trauma, because that's a part of your personal experience.
Yeah, wow, that's a big question. I'll do my best.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Take your time.
Yeah. So I think before the break, I was getting what I would call a little bit passionate, because this discussion around trauma, I'm so glad I think that there's a lot more information now out there about being trauma informed. But the issue that I have with it is it makes it seem like there's some subpopulation of our culture that we all need to be aware of that they've had trauma, when in mm-hmm. fact, it's not it's some awful. Subpopulation, it's the awful. Majority of us mm-hmm. have had trauma. Whether it be direct trauma that we've had or trauma that's been passed down, like you're saying, from generation to generation. And the trauma that's passed down from generation to generation can be in behavior, mm-hmm. like just to cut to the chase, my great grandmother came over from Russia, Poland. where they were more or less thrown out of the country because of their religion, came to the United States by herself as a like 11-year-old child. And so that was, I'm sure, a traumatic experience, mm-hmm. lots of fear where, mm. you know, your life is on the line, basically.
Can you imagine that? I mean,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And then imagine then coming into the United States, not knowing the language, mm-hmm. having to get a job. She got, you know, she got married at a very young age, worked in the sweat factories in New York, had her children. But then, yeah, she couldn't be with her kids a whole lot because she was having to work ungodly hours. So her kids were put into an orphanage where they were beaten. My grandfather had a lot of hostility when he would run away from the orphanage. His sister would get beat. And then he found out at one point that his father had a whole other family, so he was considered a bastard. So there was lots of anger. Mm-hmm. Consequently, when he got married, he would beat my mom. Mm-hmm. When my mom grew up and had children, and she didn't necessarily physically beat us, but there was a lot of what I would call abuse in some ways verbally without mm-hmm. there being an awareness that that's what was going on. Behaviorally things get transferred from one generation to the next. There's also a lot of science right now that shows that even at a cellular level, you know, even biologically, we carry that trauma through generations. So, you know, I think in the book, I'm trying to bring out also the whole idea of like, that there are populations in our society, African American population for one, that went through slavery, and I think many people don't even have a connection to their history. Like, who were the people in their right. lives who are not talking about it even? And yet right. those behaviors are still showing up in our interactions. And they're being labeled as certain things, but very few people are recognizing it as mm-hmm. As the trauma that it actually is being passed down generation to generation. And how does that show up? Like, well, it shows up, like I said earlier, where those of us that have trauma, which again is most of us, we are in a state of looking for safety, not just physical safety, mm-hmm. but even emotional safety. Emotional safety is like, am I okay right now? Am I cool in the circumstance? Do I have acceptance how I am right in this moment? And that's where the communication process is key, because the way someone steps out of having emotional safety is when they believe that there's judgment coming towards them.
Right.
Judgment can be, here's an example, like my family, you know, if you look at, you know, heritage, if someone has a judgment on you, it could actually mean that you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
If they have
mm-hmm.
a judgment of who you are, could actually equate to dying, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what's built into us at a cellular level for safety around judgment. But yet when you look at the way we speak to one another, even just in a casual way, we have so much judgment built into our everyday dialogue without us even having awareness of it.
Yeah.
So even if you don't want to have judgment on someone and you have no intention of it, it's just we are steeped with it in our language. Mm-hmm. Most of what comes out of our mouth is actually more or less a judgment than it is based in reality or observational. We're not even tracking that. So for instance, let me give an example. You know, if you tell someone you're late, you know, you're always late. If you mm-hmm. tell that to a kid, okay, that seems like, oh, a benign enough statement. It's a lot of people could say, oh, that's true, but actually that's a judgment. Mm-hmm. You're late, you're always late.
Late.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. That is a judgment. And if you say that to somebody that has had trauma, which again is two-thirds of us, boom, fight, flight, freeze. You have a judgment on me. So mm-hmm. the defenses go up, and then and fight, flight, freeze responses. I'm either gonna fight back, I'm gonna say some crappy thing back to you, right?
Exactly.
And this is actually what I believe we're even seeing happen at a political level,
mm-hmm.
right? We see this at a political level where somebody says a judgmental statement, probably not even realizing it's a judgmental statement, and the other person says something back. Like this is what's in play back and forth and back and forth. And this is Like, until we have an awareness that this is what's actually going on for most of us many times throughout a day, we're not going to get a handle on the conflict, the violence that we're seeing all around us, because this is the underpinning of all of it. And the beautiful thing about nonviolent communication is it gives us a way out of it. It literally gives us a new language and a new level of consciousness when we're with one another, and awareness, mm-hmm. so that we can still say everything that we need to say, probably with more clarity, because we are taking the judgment out. And allowing us to have these uber safe conversations with one another. Mm-hmm. And the more that we can do that with one another, the more we're able to actually build new neural connections within our brain, so that we don't so easily go into fight, flight, freeze response.
Well, I think that, and we talked about this just briefly, being able to empathize is a big key before one can move forward. And I wanted to ask you, would you talk briefly about the principles of nonviolent communication? I know being able to empathize and deeply understand others' feelings, to me, seems like a basic tenet of it. And if you will just elaborate some on, you got to have that. If you don't have that, you can't move forward, at least the way I read it.
100%.
Oh, okay, okay.
Empathy is it's kind of like the cornerstone mm-hmm. to the whole process, but it's more than the empathy that most people understand as empathy.
Yeah.
Empathy is a process that can actually be taught. I had a good friend who worked with me at Community Connections. We used to joke, we need to come up with a different word. It needs to be called empiathy or something, because when people hear empathy, they think, oh yeah, I'm empathetic. Mm-hmm. I know how to give empathy. And I want us to have a kind of a slightly different mental model of what is meant by empathy. So first and foremost, I think one of the foundational concepts, or whatever you want to call it, the key statement probably that NVC is built on, is that all conflict is a tragic expression of an unmet need.
Okay.
So what we mean by needs are the things that are universal that everybody in the world wants. That's why it's a need, mm-hmm. right? So everybody wants love, everybody wants connection, everybody wants security and safety. Everybody wants joy, fun. There are many universal human needs. I have a whole huge list of them, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants affection and power, mm-hmm. honesty, trust. Like, if you just start thinking. So we get very confused between needs and strategies, right? Needs are something that we all want and we can all agree on. It's what actually unites us as human beings. And strategies are our individualized ways of getting our needs met. When we're fighting, we usually fight or have conflict around the strategy mm-hmm. without even realizing that there's a need in play. And again, back to the main point of NVC is that all conflict is a tragic expression of an unmet need. So nobody taught me that growing up. Nobody taught me that when someone's upset, what's really going on for them is that they've got a need and they're not communicating it, because nobody ever taught us mm-hmm. to communicate at a need level, which, by the way, when you can communicate at a need level, that's one of the key ways that you take judgment out of your communication, right?
Right.
You're not saying, you're being totally unreasonable. Maybe what you're saying is I have a need for some kindness.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or I have a need for some safety in this moment, right? Now mm-hmm. it's not about the other person anymore. It's literally saying what your need is, that, by the way, everybody in the world shares the same need. So so to your question about empathy, in nonviolent communication, where in my company, the Bigby Method, we teach empathy is really three different components that you kind of interweave together. The first and foremost is presence, making sure that you're fully present with someone. If you're not present with someone, then empathy can't happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fully with someone. And truth be told, when we're in an argument with someone, usually presence is the first thing
and
that
it
goes. Yeah.
Yes.
All I want to know, all I want is for you to know what I'm thinking right now. I don't really care what's going on for you.
Exactly.
So it really, you have to do a lot of self-work to be able to hold presence in a moment when conflict is happening, right? And
right.
And again, if you've had trauma, fight, flight, freeze, that presence is the first thing usually to exit the room.
How so do you, let me interrupt you there though. How, mm-hmm. suggestions, I guess, maybe, as to how you get someone to that point, okay? How do you get them, or suggestions, or strategies, whatever, how do you get them to that point? Because we know it's easier said than done.
Oh, this is a practice. Everything
mm-hmm.
that I'm talking about here is not something that you can walk
Mm-mm.
away with in an hour or two or reading a book.
Right.
This is a practice because however many years old you are, that's how you've been responding and reacting in conflict situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a practice. And one of the things that we teach in this process is when you're in conflict, ideally what you want is you want to start in empathy first for the other, which is totally counterintuitive to everything
mm-hmm.
we've done.
That's mandatory. Yeah.
Right. Starting with empathy. And what I'm meaning by empathy, again, is presence and reflecting back what you're hearing someone say, which is not necessarily agreeing. It's just reflecting back what you're hearing so that they know that you're hearing them at least.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking needs guesses, because if all conflict is a tragic expression of an unmet need, then when you take a needs guess, now I'm at least leaning in with some curiosity about what's actually going on for you. Now you have a sense that there is maybe some empathy there, right?
Right.
So
give us an example. I say that because I'll tell you what comes to mind. And you may not use this one, but this is what it reminds me of. The example of the young male student, autistic student, who was having difficulties saying,
oh,
yeah.
In the book you're talking about?
In the book I'm thinking now. But
that's a perfect example.
Yeah, that's
so
what
this
came
is a
to
perfect
mind.
Example. And oh, by the way, because I worked with kids, I think you know, because
mm-hmm.
you interviewed me, you know, I was working for years with kids in our restorative justice program here. Some of the quote, what other people would call toughest kids in our community. These were kids
mm-hmm.
13 to 17 that had trouble with our legal system. And I remember when I came on your show, you were like, what is it that you're doing with these kids? Because it's clearly like something is going on. And again, these are the kids that most people could not get an ounce of cooperation out of, right?
Right.
Well, what we're doing is the very same thing that I'm talking about here, which is starting with empathy first, not with judgment about
mm-hmm.
who they are, their behavior. It's like, it's really leaning into, like, if they're doing something, it's because of a need. Let me go there first. So in answer to your question, giving the example that I have in the book, and I give several examples
yes.
for a school scenario,
yeah.
a business scenario, personal scenario, this kid came in and was in a funk, what I would call a funk. And the teacher was trying to give this student some space. And I think she approached his desk and, you know, said something like, I don't remember what she said, but she was trying to give him support.
Right.
And he said, would you politely f*** off, I think is what he said. I think you'll have to bleep that out here.
Yeah, we will.
Well, this teacher was majorly trained in NBC.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, most teachers would be in a moment like that. You need to leave and, you know, would react, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this teacher knew, okay, well, this is really about a need and there's a different way of handling it. So she sat down at her desk. She gave herself some empathy, which is a part of this process back
mm-hmm.
to if you can't give empathy, if you can't stay present, all that is your body system trying to say like, wow, like I myself need some empathy right now. And clearly she wasn't going to get it from that student, right?
No.
But there's a way in this process that you can give yourself empathy or you can get empathy from a third party person. So that's what she did. She stuck, she sat down, she probably breathed. She started trying to get connected with what were her own needs in that moment and get really like physically, viscerally connected with her own needs in a felt sense kind of a way and stay with that for a bit. And then she was able to give empathy to the kid, you know, when the kid was ready, rather than go into, you know, that was rude of you and that was totally unacceptable, which, by the way, those are all judgments. If you say that to a child, especially a kid that has had trauma, boom, fight, flight, freeze comes right online right there. But instead, she was probably like, yeah, you know, I'm guessing when I approached you, what I'm guessing is you were really needing some space and clearly upset about something and maybe just wanting some understanding about all of that. So space is a need. Understanding is a need. If you just heard me just throw those out, right?
You're right.
So if you just, and you're not saying what the person, the needs are, you're taking guesses. You don't know. This is a totally different approach. Most people, when you're in conflict with them, if you start to, like, rather than give an explanation or correct them, if you just start to wonder about what the needs are, it could really de-escalate everything because you're leaning into what is actually real in the moment, right? And so, you know, after giving some empathy with presence and reflecting what the student was saying and taking some needs guesses, then you're able to say, you know, when the person has an experience of being fully heard and there's connection, that's how you create connection, then, you know, it's not just about a one-way thing. Then you can, you know, and I've done this many, many times with students. Hey, you know, anything else you want to be heard about? Nope. Okay. Are you open? Are you open to hearing how that whole situation was for me? That in NVC, that's called making a connecting request. You ask before you express. And if you just heard somebody else, usually they're very much open to hearing what you have to say if you just heard them. I was always
Hold your thoughts again. I'm always interrupting, but I'm sorry. I'm looking at the clock. I was hoping I could kind of weave it in. But we're going to take a brief break here on 411 Teen, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Nonverbal communication aims to foster mutual respect, empathy, and cooperation in communication. The approach is grounded in the belief that human beings have the capacity to have compassion, and that behaviors stemming from violence are learned, are conditional responses. NVC seeks to create a more compassionate world by focusing on language and communication strategies. It has been utilized in a variety of settings: education, conflict resolution, personal relationships, business. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Dr. Cindy Bigby, author of My Link to Mildred, a narrative on NVC as a transformative tool. Cindy, I had to interrupt you, but you can continue your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying how, you know, you were asking me some time back about empathy, and we were talking about how empathy is so key to the NVC process. But I also want people to understand that expression is also very key to it. But what we do is we kind of hold, if possible, on the expression, give empathy first, and then when the person has an experience of being heard, then using what I call a connecting request, are you open to hearing how it was for me? And then moving into expression at that point. And when you do express in nonviolent communication, there's very specific ways that we teach expressing, which is sticking with observations, true feelings, and the needs, because the needs, again, are usually what are at the crux of it all. So I just want people to know, like, empathy is really, really important, but I don't want folks to think, well, when do you ever get a chance to say your side of things? Well, you certainly, that is built into this process as well.
Okay. What does the research indicate about the effectiveness of NVC Bigby method?
Well, I mean, I can speak firsthand because I ran the restorative justice program here for, I guess, 8 years or so. It's still going on out of the Palmer Monroe Center. And we had the good fortune where we grew so big, because we'd have these kids who would be, they would be court ordered usually to come to Community Connections and pretty upset about being there. And then the whole process was built around the NBC, modeling it, teaching it. And what we would find is most of the time the kids would never want to leave. And so we, our circles grew to the upwards of like 40 some odd people in a circle, because these kids would have, would finally have a place of true emotional safety. And they wouldn't want to ever leave it. And so we would have the kids come back as volunteers. I still actually, I no longer work at Community Connections, but I run a company called the Bigby Method, where I'm trying to bring this same process that we did there on a large scale. And I still have some of the kids from way back when that are working with me to this day.
That's to me, that's the greatest testament. Yeah.
Right. If you've got people that you, you know, from, I actually started teaching NBC, I guess it was probably like 2009 at Rickards High School. And many of those kids are still connected to the work. And that was a long time ago, right?
So, well, again, that's a real testimony.
Yeah, it really is.
To the effectiveness. What role, from your experiences, what role does one's culture or cultural context play in the participation and effectiveness of NBC?
Can you say that again?
Just what role does one's culture, does the culture have an influence, or the cultural context in which, you know, you're functioning? What role does that play?
I don't think it really does.
Okay.
I really don't. Okay. I mean, I think it was interesting because when I was at Community Connections and I first started there, I usually, when I share the template for nonviolent communication, I start with a personal story of a time when my own daughter, when she was in high school, said F you to me. And how at the time I was actually ironically teaching nonviolent communication at Rickards High School, and she was in the class, and how I was forced to approach it differently because I was teaching NVC. Otherwise I would have resulted to the old way of like, go to your room. How dare you speak to me like that? Right. Instead I had to use a different approach. And I was told at the time by someone from the Black community that this would never work with the kids at the Community Connections program, because, you know, there's this whole thing around, like, you know, authority and respect and place and all of that. And at the time, like, I wasn't sure whether that was true or not, but I can tell you, you know, we worked there again for 8 years, and I had every kind of kid, every age group there was, every religion, and it didn't matter, because I think it comes down to this whole idea that it's all based in these universal human needs, right? It doesn't matter what culture you come from. Everybody really wants connection. Everybody wants well-being. Everybody wants kindness. Everybody wants security. That's the language of what we're doing here. And so it's applicable to anybody, anywhere. Now, you may have to have, you know, we did a lot of creating connection and trust on the front end to kind of move people to a place of being open to learning about this, but that didn't, it wasn't even hard to do. I mean, we got it down to a science, really, to move people to a place of like, I kind of like being here. I kind of like learning this, you know, and it really didn't matter. Am I answering your question?
Well, yeah, I'm also thinking about African-Americans, Hispanic, other communities of color who may have experienced systemic racism and marginalization. Is NVC sensitive to these experiences? I mean, I'm just asking. I don't know. Is it sensitive to these experiences? How accessible is NVC to these populations?
Well, I wish I had some of my African-American friends that are on that have gone through this process, because they could speak to that probably a whole lot better than I could. But I know that I've had many people go through that, you know, are not of my same culture and are of those cultures. And they have said that, you know, they really, they wish everybody in their community had this process, you know, because they have found it to be so powerful and so helpful. So, you know, I don't know if I'm that absolute right person to answer that question, because, you know, I can only speak from my own experience, but my own experience in interacting with other people from other cultures seems like they're, you know, it's the whole thing is trying to lean in to empathy and really hearing. And I think that that's the missing piece when it comes to people having an experience of being disenfranchised, is that we don't have a language or a way of interacting with one another where people really experience being fully held and heard.
Mm-hmm.
That's a missing component,
yeah,
in my opinion. And if we can have more and more people do that, rather than pivoting to what I call other conversational responses, which is what we have a whole lot of happening out there. You know, people are trying to explain that their experience of disenfranchisement, and then we're coming back with other responses about it, you know, or like trying to make sense of it, or giving advice about it, or correcting about it, or even sympathizing around it. Like none of that is holding space for someone to be heard around it. Okay. Most people don't know how to do that. That's exactly what NVC is trying to help people learn how to do.
What about, and you mean, I'm just thinking as we talk, what about the trust and the identification with the trainer, whoever is, have you found that makes it a difference? I'm thinking about race.
Oh, yeah. I always appreciate that you bring up these conversations.
You know,
I really
come.
Do.
Do you?
Really
okay.
Do. No, I do.
Well,
I'm
we've
not,
talked before, so you kind of know.
I'm not being sarcastic at all. I've really embraced the conversation. Here's the feedback that I've had personally on this. At Community Connections, it wasn't an issue. I mean, I think it probably was an issue in the immediate, like a kid comes in or a parent comes in and they're wondering, who the heck is this person? And these people, they don't look like me. They, you know, I can't relate to them at all. But you saw the kids. I mean,
yes.
You were with
yourself.
And they were not like atypical. The kids that came on your program, I think there were 5 or 6 of them at the time, were very typical, the same experience over and over again. So I think there was definitely a way of reaching across the divide. But I also have had, like, I have this one good friend here locally who, her brother was in the program, and we just struck it off. We struck up a great friendship in that she was really interested in trying to reach her brother because their mom had passed, which was a big reason for a lot of the turmoil and the disconnection that was happening in their family. So I used to meet this person in the South Side Library during lunch hour and trained her on NVC, and she for years has really wanted to support me in my work, and to do that, showing up as somebody that can look like other people in the audience, right? So I think she has some, I think she just thinks it would be easier if somebody that looked like everybody showed up with the skills rather than somebody that didn't, because then there's nothing that you have to overcome at the very beginning of this whole thing.
Okay. I am talking with Dr. Cindy Bigby, author of My Link to Mildred, Interrupting the Epidemic of Trauma via Nonviolent communication. Cindy, share, because we've been talking and the program's almost over. I'm looking at the clock and I thought, oh, we're talking about your book. Share where one can purchase the book.
Yeah, I can do that. I just do want to say one last comment.
Well, we got time. We got time. I mean, we got a few minutes.
Well, about, I do have sadness because if you look at NBC, you know, groups across, there is definitely underrepresentation from minority groups. I think that the Center for Nonviolent Communication is working real hard to make a difference in that. And we're not just talking about Black and brown cultures.
No.
We're talking like across the board, right? I think it's, you know, been right now more accessible to people that have more abundance, you know, more time, more resource. I really want to change that. I've been trying in our own community to make it so that is not the case. And I will continue to work on that because I think, like we started out the program talking about, that this is work that is really valuable for everybody everywhere. So just wanted to make note of that.
Fine. Yes.
Yeah. And my book is on Amazon. So you can definitely buy it right off of Amazon. I also wanted to put a plug in that my company is called The Bigby Method. And if people are interested in learning nonviolent communication, we do provide an intro training and then what something we call the empathy gym after you go through the intro training. The empathy gym is designed for you to stay in the process and to continually get support around the process, because as we talked about earlier, this isn't something that you get in an hour or two.
Right.
This is something like you just, you have to, I've dedicated my life to it. Not only because I think it's a great thing, but because I want to live in integrity with it. It's not an easy thing to do. I've been learning and teaching and working with the process for many, many years. I still don't have it down perfectly, but I sure do try to stay in integrity with it. And I think that, yeah, I have a lot of really sweet connections and ability to come back to connection most of the time as a result of knowing this process.
What would be some of the misconceptions that you would like to address with NVC, that people have about NVC?
Well, I think some people think, oh, it's very robotic. You know, people talk weird when they talk like that. Well, it is another language. So just like, you know, if you're trying to learn another language, it sounds strange to your ear. It's the same thing here. I think some people think just because you're using this process that maybe there's an element of authenticity that is doesn't go along with it. Whereas I don't really believe that's true. I just think that there's a learning curve. And so it might sound strange. So I like to say that, you know, at the beginning, you're using the template that we lay out for you as kind of like training wheels, you know, when you're learning to ride a bike, you need training wheels to help keep your balance, right? To keep you going with it. But you don't always need them. Once you kind of have the basics down, you could take your training wheels off and make your bike your own. Same exact thing here. But it takes time. All of that takes time. And then ultimately, it's not even about the words that we are learning or how to use the words. It's really about the intention. Okay. Is your intention to connect or is your intention to be right? If you're holding on to being right, then this might not be what you want to use. But you know what we found is if your intention is to connect, then usually it's not like you can get the other person to your side, but there's usually more openness, more ability to navigate sticky circumstances. So you can't go in with, oh, I'm just doing this because I'm going to eventually get them to do what I want them to do. It really has to be pure about just wanting to have connection and be able to be present. Presence is the foundation for all of this.
In 30 seconds or so, are there any words of wisdom that you would share, the takeaway of this book?
Oh, for the book?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I'm very grateful that it was I would say almost like channeled through me, this book. Mm-hmm. It was very cathartic in writing about the passing of my mom and our history together, and the way my mom and I, near the end, we were kind of in awe because we mm-hmm. couldn't believe that the tragedy and trauma that had been passed down through generations was being turned towards such light.
Well, it's time out, and I want to say, you know, many thanks to Dr. Cindy Bigby for writing My Link to Mildred, Interrupting the Epidemic of Trauma via Nonviolent Communication. It's a powerful narrative on nonviolent communication. Much appreciation to my listening audience for your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.